Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. I'm Susan Lee Bell, and today I'm joined by Sarah Hughes, assistant professor in the School for Environment and Sustainability at the University of Michigan. She's here to discuss her terrific new book, Repowering Cities: Governing Climate Change Mitigation in New York, Los Angeles, and Toronto, published by Cornell University Press, 2019. Welcome to the show, Sarah.
Thanks so much for having me.
So your book looks at the way cities have actually approached climate change mitigation, as opposed to international organizations, national leaders. And you argue that the way that cities have approached this is to have a common set of governing strategies rather than any particular city characteristic or policy agenda. And you locate the sort of capacities in their ability to build institutions, coalitions, and capacities. And so as you see it, the foundation of any effort to kind of change cities so that they could deal with something like climate change is something not particular to the characteristics, but something that we can identify and study. And you've got an incredible set of cases that I cannot wait to talk to you about. But before we do that, tell me a little bit about how you came to write this book and how it fits into your wider scholarship.
Sure. So the way I came to write this book was I'd been working for a while, both as a doctoral student and as a postdoc fellow on issues related to cities and climate change. And this was around 2012, 2013, and there was a lot of excitement about the fact that cities were stepping in and developing really ambitious climate change goals for themselves in the absence of federal and international leadership. So, there's just a lot of excitement that this was happening. More and more cities were making these pledges. There were emerging global networks of cities that were exciting to watch. And it really was injecting, I think, a sense of hope into a lot of the climate change debate. And I was working with colleagues like Patty Romero-Lankau at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, folks at the EPA, Office of Research and Development, on how we could sort of what cities were doing and what we should take from it. And what I noticed was that we were starting to know a fair bit about why cities were doing this. I think that was the question a lot of us started with was, wow, this is a surprise. We wouldn't expect cities to take this on, to take it upon themselves to address this kind of large collective action problem. Why is that so? And there were a lot of really great studies coming out showing why cities were doing this, and also doing an analysis of what cities were committing to, what they had in their plans, and this kind of a thing. But we hadn't really yet gotten to the point of asking questions about implementation or what it takes to go from setting a really ambitious target, like, we as a city would like to reduce our emissions by 30%, 50%, 80%. What does it look like to go from that, from setting that target to really achieving those goals, to experiencing or realizing those emissions reductions? And so I decided that that was where I was going to put my own effort for the next, turned out to be 5 years or so. but that was where it came from.
And your training, where did you come out of, and how much science background did you have before digging into this?
Sure. So I came at it with a mixed interdisciplinary background. So I had some familiarity with some of the basic scientific principles from my undergraduate and master's degree training, but I did my PhD work really focused on urban policy and politics. At the time, I was focused on water issues, water conservation, water sustainability, but I was coming at it from the perspective of someone who's interested in cities and someone who's interested in how cities work politically, how they, what kind of policies cities can and do adopt. And I think that was another gap I saw in the literature at the time, is that a lot of the folks who were interested in this new role that cities were playing in climate policy were coming at it from an international relations perspective, right? Like these city networks, cities engaged in global conversations, or even some of the climate negotiations. What does this mean for global politics? And these are really great questions. But I thought that there was more to be said about it from the perspective of cities. And what does this mean? What does this shift mean from the local perspective?
So in your work, you're living and sort of breathing climate change and water politics, but not all of our listeners are focused on that as their political issue. So could you remind people of what is the problem facing the cities? Just give us a very brief understanding of what the levels of greenhouse gases mean for the cities. You know, why is this a problem? So we can, before we dig into what the cities are trying to do, we can understand what the problem is.
Yes, that is a great question. And I think this is what makes, to me, what makes some of the policy and governance questions so interesting, is that the idea, or the sort of broad umbrella of, you know, the idea of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in cities, in order to understand what that looks like, you have to drill down into particular sectors of the city, different sources of emissions. So in most cities, emissions are primarily coming from energy, the sort of energy mix that the city relies upon, whether it's coal or hydro or nuclear, and what the carbon intensity of that mix looks like. And then there's a chunk that's typically attributable to the built environment, so the energy demands of the city, how much energy the city's buildings are using to turn on the lights, you know, power the air conditioning and this kind of a thing. And then a third big chunk is typically coming from the transportation system. So the way this gets calculated is different under different frameworks, but generally the idea is we're talking about emissions coming from personal vehicles, transit systems. Sometimes we're talking about airline and shipping traffic, But those are the three. There's a smaller fourth bucket that usually gets calculated under waste. So the way that cities handle their waste generates emissions to a greater or lesser extent. But those are the sort of big buckets of emissions that cities are responsible for, and that when it comes time to moving from that target to, you know, kind of on the ground strategies, those are the intervention points that we're talking about.
So when you were introducing things earlier, you were distinguishing between the whether cities would do this or how. And your comparative study is really about the how. And you're using New York, LA, and Toronto as empirical cases for telling us about how it is each of these three city governments moved from making a commitment to actually mitigating greenhouse gases. Can you start us off by telling us why these three cities and what they, well, let's just start with why those three cities?
Sure. So a big part of what I was looking for in choosing cases were cities that had made commitments to reduce greenhouse gas emissions long enough ago that we could reasonably expect to evaluate implementation. So honestly, when I first came to the study, I had been thinking more about issues on the adaptation side, how cities were changing to adapt to to a changing climate, to new different patterns of rainfall, heat events, and this kind of a thing. But that's so new that we can't really get our heads around what implementation looks like. But fortunately, cities have been acting to reduce emissions, work on the mitigation side for much longer. So these three cities had each made pretty formal, pretty detailed commitments to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by a significant amount in the year 2007. So this all started, the project all started around 2014, 2015. So I felt that gave me enough room to work with in thinking about how these plans had been implemented and wanting to reasonably expect to see results, you know, to see reductions in emissions that we could point to and measure as a result of these plans being put into place. So that was the first level of selection. I was interested in large cities and that's also who's acting, who were the early actors. There aren't a lot of smaller cities that were early actors in the way that these cities were. And so that narrowed the field down itself pretty significantly. And then fortunately, these three cities had made these relatively similar commitments to reduce emissions, but came at the job of achieving those emissions with very different, sets of powers, emissions mixes, sort of mixes of where their emissions were coming from, and what kind of powers they could bring to bear in reducing those emissions. So, for example, Los Angeles is always a very special case because it has its own municipally owned energy utility, which is unusual, especially for a city of its size. So it gives it a lot of authority over its energy system. But it has a pretty weak mayor system institutionally, where by contrast, New York City has a very strong mayor system institutionally. The mayor's position comes with a lot of power and authority, but it's part of a regional transportation and electricity network that gives it somewhat more muted powers in making its own independent decisions about those sectors. And then we've got Toronto, which is in the Canadian system, which constitutionally allocates the least amount of authority to its local governments of the three.
Just backing up a little bit, there's a literature that looks at cities as bastions of democracy, as places where we can work these things out in a kind of nitty-gritty way, as sort of the perfect laboratories to do this kind of work. So before we go to your conclusions, where do you place yourself in the literature of cities, and how optimistic do you remain after this study about the possibilities and potentials for these three, the kinds of big cities that you're taking, that you're looking at in your book?
This is really the million-dollar question. And honestly, that continuum, or that literature, is also a lot of what motivated me to take this on, because I was starting to sort of reel from the different takes on cities, where, just like you say, there's this kind of avalanche of books coming out talking about how cities were going to save us. You know, Benjamin Barber's "If Mayors Ruled the World." And it's a really compelling idea, and it makes a lot of sense in a lot of ways. But, you know, I was also participating in pretty engaged in an urban politics community that was centrally focused on, you know, inadequate housing, failure to address poverty in cities. It's pretty clear that you know, our transit systems, our infrastructure is not being updated in the way that it should. So I felt like when you stopped and looked around at cities sometimes and sort of peeled the covers back a little bit, it didn't always feel like you were living in, you know, some kind of the urban utopia or something. And so I was really struck by that contrast. And to me, the climate change, the arena of climate change embodies that dichotomy so well, because on the one hand, you have all this enthusiasm and leadership coming around, you know, emerging around cities that taking on climate change, and that's so important. And the goals are clearly important and impressive. And at the same time, you've got a lot of people very skeptical that that these kinds of changes can take place locally. So I'm repeating what you said a bit, but and this question then of where the book lies is trying to take that tension up, basically, and say, okay, well, let's look at what happened then, right? We've got excitement. These are three cities that have generated a lot of excitement about what they're doing with climate change, but there are three cities that face a lot of problems. And, you know, I think a lot of people that live in those cities don't always feel so optimistic about what the city is able to deliver. And so that's exactly kind of what I wanted to take up with this study, is let's start, you know, looking at it in depth and see. And honestly, I came away from the project more optimistic than I went into it, because there was, on the whole, I would say I felt differently about some of the different cities, I think. But on the whole, there was more concrete activity and policy change and investment to point to than I had expected, or that than the sort of pessimistic take would lead you to expect. And so I think going forward, then my take would be that there's a lot that cities are and can doing. And I think we can't discount that. And just, I guess, spoiler alert, but that, you know, they're not going to go all the way on their own either.
I think the tone of the book really communicates that. I think that you have this very balanced view. You don't present the city as you know, the perfect place, but you have admiration for what they're doing. It's a really balanced, I thought, you know, from my read, I'm not a specialist in your area. I really felt that tension as I was reading it, and also felt that along the way you were providing very helpful guideposts for the reader to take them to this literature, to take them to the barber, to have them understand how cities have been held up and the potential for them. And the, you know, you make a really great case for the fact that this is important to think about cities, but then to also speak to the limitations. Before we go into the three-part framework of the book, you use two terms. One is wicked problems, and the other is the iron law of resource mobilization. And so before I ask you to sort of describe the wider argument, would you mind just putting those two terms on the table for all of us?
Sure. And this idea of wicked problems in particular, I know not everyone loves this term or finds it particularly useful, but the reason I found it useful to at least engage with here was because I thought it really helps to capture just how new and complex and uncertain this job is, especially from the perspective of city governments, where you're suddenly confronted with this task of doing completely, you know, meeting completely new targets, working in sectors in completely new ways, working with new partners. There's just so much that's new and uncertain and complex about it that I found it quite useful to think about it from that perspective. And so, I mean, the idea of a wicked problem generally is, to me, that's the sort of shortcut definition, is that it's imbued with complexity and uncertainty. And there's not necessarily a lot of consensus around what the right way or what the most effective way is moving forward. And I think that also speaks to this newness, right? We haven't been here before. There's not a lot to turn to look for best practices or what's worked in other places, especially when we think about cities that started doing this work in 2007. And then the reason I think it's particularly helpful in the urban context is because it then helps us understand what city governments have to do from a governance perspective. You know, what those moves look like in order to take things forward, and it ties in then to this idea of resource mobilization. And I use this phrase from Clarence Stone's work, who's one of the, you know, of course, real heavy hitters in the urban politics world. And he has written since the 80s about this idea that because of the institutional limitations, political limitations of city governments, in most arenas, you know, not just in climate change, in most arenas, in order for them to achieve their goals, they have to mobilize others. They have to mobilize other resources, other actors. That's almost their central job, is to serve as that mobilizer, and that you know. And as Stone has updated his own understanding of the urban political economy, he's held fast to this idea, this iron law of resource mobilization. And I found this also to be particularly helpful in the context of climate mitigation, because we know going into it that this isn't something city governments can do on their own. You know, for sure, we know that they're going to need partners, they're going to need outside resources. And so this idea of that being the primary mode by which city governments activate and move toward their goals, I found to be really helpful, and ties it in with this larger literature on just how cities work generally.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, let's start with a three-part framework before we move to the three cities and how they've approached these problems. So really quickly, just give us the three parts so that we can hear that as we work through the cities.
Sure. So in the framework, the idea is that it's a framework for how we or I should go about evaluating that implementation process for urban climate policy. And the idea is that we should look at first the policies and programs cities adopt for the purpose of reducing emissions, and that these policies and programs will necessarily be specific to the authorities that cities have and their particular mix of emissions, you know, that they'll have to develop a set of policy tools fit to the context. But then the second part, a second thing we can look at is what these governing strategies look like. So going back to this idea of resource mobilization, what are the strategies cities govern? City governments use to do that mobilization and to move governance forward. And I argue that those are shared because of the shared, broadly shared political economic context, institutional context of cities, you know, going back to Stone's idea of these kind of inherent limitations, that there would be shared strategies that are useful for cities to do that resource mobilization. And then third, of course, we need to think about, look at the outcomes, look at what's happened, what kind of impacts we can point to as a result of this work.
So in chapter three, after you've presented the frameworks, you provide this incredibly helpful overview of the challenges and capacities of each city. Can you give us a brief version of, you've started that earlier, but what are these three cities like? How are they different? What are the challenges and what kind of institutions and other resources do they already have in place?
Sure. So they have some really, just fascinating similarities and differences in that sense. And so in New York City, this was a city that was, had some kind of piecemeal efforts in the past to address climate change, to build in sustainability into the city goals. The council had been pushing this for a bit before 2007, but it has this really powerful mayoral position, and it really needed a mayor who was on board. And it turned out that Bloomberg was that mayor. For a variety of reasons, he was convinced by advisors and others that sustainability and climate change were the big issues that the city needed to address. And so he assembled a really talented team, put out a really ambitious plan. And they really, that plan, the One NYC plan in 2007, I mean, it was really a sort of flagship document, a flagship plan in this field. And then, like I said, you know, they had a lot of really great executive leadership, very ambitious and well-developed plan, but have some challenges in the sense that, like I said, they don't have, you know, they're working in regional transportation and electricity networks. they had a fairly contentious relationship with state government at the time. And their emissions mix, because they have such a great public transit system, a lot of their emissions are coming from buildings. Something close to 80% of their greenhouse gas emissions are from building energy use. So on the one hand, you know, this provides a really compelling case and a sort of clear, kind of call to action here. But it's a really tough nut to crack is, making big inroads on existing buildings through retrofits.
Let me interrupt you for just a second, since we're in real time and Bloomberg just ran for the Democratic nomination. And just as a footnote, as you watched Bloomberg run after having studied so carefully his work on climate change, do you have any insights or surprises about how he ran, the extent to which it was about climate change or not about climate change?
It was fascinating to watch. And I was definitely surprised at how much he didn't mention his experience with climate change. That was my sense, especially in the first Democratic primary debate. I would have thought, I'm biased, but I would have thought that would have been something he could really come out and made an impact with, because, he made such a big impact in New York City. He was the UN envoy for climate change for a time. He led the C40 Cities Climate Network. He's got a strong record on climate change at this point, I didn't see him leveraging it. I think he was, I got the sense he was reeling a little bit in the first debate after Elizabeth Warren gave him her 2 cents. But I was surprised about that. And at the same time, people, there are other issues, right? And even though he has a strong climate record, his broader record was kind of up on trial as well, I guess.
No, that's helpful. Sorry, I derailed you about the other cities. Okay, so that's New York. What about Los Angeles or Toronto?
Yeah, no problem. Bloomberg's a fascinating character, there's no doubt.
I have to agree with you. As I read the book, I thought, I'm originally from New York, but I wasn't in New York when Bloomberg was mayor. And it really did surprise me that Bloomberg didn't make more of this success and of this position, because it would have combined a progressive issue combating climate change with his more conservative background on other issues.
And that's how
reading your book, it was a real reminder of all the things he had done.
Yeah, no, that's right. And that was how he did it in New York too. He worked through the business community. He had the business sector on board with his goals, and he's really effective. So I'm not sure. In the case of Los Angeles, this is a city that also had a fairly environmentally friendly political context or kind of setup going into it. And Villaraigosa, who was mayor at the time, capitalized on that, built a nice coalition around his Green LA plan, and really was also listening to a broad set of advisors who was telling him, this is what we need to do. This is a new important direction for the city. And it didn't quite get the same kind of legs under it as a plan, as a kind of institutionalized feature of his administration. It didn't get the same kind of legs in it that it did as it did in New York City. I think partly it was because it is a weaker mayoral position. It required a lot more from city council, and he had a pretty tough relationship with city council. And so this too, and this was something I really try to do in the book, is, that climate change is no different than any other policy issue for cities, right? It's shaped by by city politics. You know, it's shaped by the relationship between the mayor and the city council. And I think especially those of us who really spend a lot of time in the environmental field and environmental spaces, I think it can be easy to lose sight of that. But then, like I said, Los Angeles also has this, its own utility. And so that has just been a huge advantage for the city. It's also, of course, in California, one of the most progressive states on climate change. It's setting targets for cities. It's setting targets for utilities. So it has a lot to work with in that sense. Toronto had a really progressive mayor, David Miller, at the time. Same kind of story. There was just a lot of progressive momentum in the city around environmental issues, around climate change. They had finally gotten a progressive mayor into office and had this plan come out setting these targets. And I think it, you know, they had this strong champion in David Miller at the time, but he was followed fairly quickly by Rob Ford, who really had little to no interest in continuing these programs. Where Toronto got lucky, in some ways, like Los Angeles, at the time, the province of Ontario was making really really ambitious inroads on reducing coal-fired power plants, where the province is now completely free of coal-fired power plants. And so the city, because they're on that network, they benefit from that too. So they had a plan that at this point and for a long time has largely been developed, implemented, innovated upon by really, really dedicated city staff, really smart, really just fully committed city staff have really been carrying this.
One of the assumptions in political science is often that there's a problem or there's a difference, not a problem, but there's a real difference in delivering policy on the environment because it isn't something that necessarily can be felt by the voters who exist right now. There aren't always tangibles that can either be seen or experienced. And so that it actually is a very, very different challenge for a leader who is elected to take it on because it doesn't have that kind of immediate deliverable. Did you find that, or do you find voters responding to climate change the same way that they would respond to building parks or improving roads?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think what's special about doing this at the city level or in the urban context is that a lot of measures that that can be taken locally to reduce greenhouse gas emissions have fairly tangible outcomes. So it is things like building energy retrofits that affect, you know, your energy bills, but also require that you pay for and live through a retrofit of your home or your office or whatever it is. Or you start getting into transportation politics, right? Building new infrastructure, changing the way people get to work. So I think that's something that's a little bit special about climate action at the local level is that it almost by necessity does have that more tangible kind of local landing than renewable portfolio standards at the state level that you might not actually see. There's maybe a note on your energy bill, where in cities, they're probably going to be thinking about rooftop solar, right? That's going to be more visible and this kind of a thing. And so I think on the one hand, you get residents who are engaging with the city's climate plan, right, when they sort of develop a plan for climate change. And that often is a popular move. At least the cities that are doing it are typically doing it because their residents want it, right? That it's like, we're a climate leader, we're going to act on climate change, we have a climate plan, and that's connecting with some kind of liberal or environmentally aware voting base. But then what happens is then to reach those goals, like I was saying, you have to start getting into really specific sectors, really specific infrastructures, and then it becomes different politics, I think. You know, when you start saying, okay, how are we going to expand our bus network, or how are we going to start building, who's going to pay for new light rail? That's a different politics. Or how are we going to encourage density? I mean, this is the big one right now, right? A lot of cities, an important tool they have in their toolbox is to increase density. It helps with transit. It can help with efficiencies and this kind of a thing, improves mobility. But increasing density is really unpopular policy.
So one of the points that you make in the book is that the context, the sources of power, as you've described it now, even where people get their energy are pretty unique among these three cities. I'm wondering what the wider lessons to draw from this comparative study are for smaller cities. And I'm also wondering, I know you don't have the data, so I'm asking you to guess, but what about the cities in the Midwest, the South, the West, places like Houston? Would what you are observing in these three cities apply to the smaller cities and to the larger cities of the Midwest and the South and West?
Mm-hmm. So I think that the broader applicability and lessons to be learned at a minimum can come from these governing strategies, so that it might not be that every city has the power to completely redo their building energy code the way that New York City did. That's a pretty special power that the city has. But I think these governing strategies, building institutions, and building capacity and building coalitions, I think those are going to be common and effective strategies in almost any city. And I think sometimes, that can be an even more important lesson to be transferred between cities, right? So you'll see a lot of kind of how-to documents or kind of learning documents that'll be focused on, well, we put in new bike lanes, and these are our bike lanes, or we put in new solar panels. And it might be that a smaller city in the Midwest, a Sunbelt city or something like this, maybe they get to the point where they say, okay, you know, we get it. We see the need to do something about climate change. We don't know where to start. It might be more helpful to think about how other cities have gone about doing that resource mobilization, right? Doing that, doing that forward motion rather than the very specific policy tools that they used. So it might be, I think, helpful for cities to understand how it was that New York City got their climate plans really institutionalized within city government by passing that kind of legislation, or what kind of coalition building efforts help Toronto pass, energy loan programs under a really conservative mayor, and this kind of a thing. So I think that getting started on the governance side can be perhaps the most translatable lessons from these cases.
The book uses a combination of interviews, government reports, all sorts of archival documents, newspaper articles. I'm wondering if there were particular interviews or particular finds that surprised you. You know, do you have some sort of juicy research story to make the politics nerds in our audience jump?
That's a great question. So one that stands out to me, the first thing that's coming to mind was an interview I did in New York with a woman who worked in the legislative office. So I'm going to forget now the exact name of the office, but it's essentially the office that handles legislation and helps it move through city council. And talking with her, was one of the conversations that made me really hopeful and optimistic, actually. She talked about how, they had passed more than 100 pieces of legislation through city council designed to improve energy efficiency, create new rules, for the building code, as I mentioned. They all passed unanimously through city council. I mean, she was just overflowing with joy with her job and this experience. And she, hearing her talk about, she's saying, I've never seen this before. It's so collaborative. We're all doing it and we're making a difference. It was simultaneously, I found it a lot of fun because it's the sort of sausage making side. It wasn't a counselor. It was someone who's doing the unglamorous work of, the sort of nuts and bolts of getting these bills through, loving her job, and really facilitating cutting edge policy coming through this council. So I don't know if that's particularly juicy, but it was a lot of fun at the time and was a different perspective on some of the more cynical takes sometimes of that backroom sausage making work.
Sure. And also, look, studying the environment, especially climate change, can be grim.
That's right.
And I think that many researchers are faced with the problem, and this is not exclusive, obviously, to people who study climate change, people who study genocide, that you're looking at something where the trajectory is not optimistic. And so I can imagine that sitting with somebody who is making things happen at that level and who expresses optimism would be incredibly encouraging.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right. You sort of want to have something to point to. Like you said, when you do get a sort of close up look at how much is not happening and how tough it is, and everybody fighting tooth and nail along the way. Having something like that to point to is can be a pretty big deal.
So you and I are recording this on a day when most of the United States is engaged in thinking about COVID-19 and what they can do, can't do. And a lot of mayors today, especially in these densely populated large cities, are struggling with what to do. I'm wondering, again, I know this is not your case study, but you looked very carefully at these three cities. Knowing what you know about them and their capacities and institutions, what do you think are the challenges for the three of them as they face this very, very different city problem?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, and on one level, there's this fundamental tension, right, where the thing that we love about cities and the thing that makes cities thrive is connection and that proximity. And that's exactly what we're trying to minimize right now, right, in the midst of this outbreak. And so it must be really challenging for leaders who are used to and focused on promoting that and managing, I guess, to an extent too, that proximity, to then suddenly be trying to find ways to keep people away from each other and justify that. And of course, it is justified, but helping people understand why that's necessary. And I think too, this is my take anyway, is that this is another example where federal government response has been a bit slow and has been a bit lacking. And this time it's happening, in this case, it's happening very quickly, but it is another example where city leaders are having to engage in new ways, in new policy areas, and make new kinds of decisions and provide new kinds of leadership. So, who knows? Maybe engaging with these kinds of issues, whether it's climate change, immigration, having that that experience of kind of stepping into the void, maybe it's coming in handy right now.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Thank you for sharing this book. I really enjoyed reading it. And as I've already said, it's not in my subfield, and I found it clear, accessible. I felt that you gave me a background on the literature without drowning me. And I understood why what you were arguing was both consistent with and complementary to what had come before. I'm wondering what your new project, what are you working on now?
Sure. So at the end of this project, sort of right when I was wrapping up, there was a kind of new wave of climate plans coming out from all three cities, a kind of updated take on their climate plans. And what all three cities did in these new plans was really shift their focus much more squarely on the intersection between climate action and inequality. And so this is where I think it's pretty clear this is where the policy momentum is headed, and I think for some good reasons. So that's where a lot of my work is focused right now, is how cities can and do make those links between justice, inequality, and climate preparedness, climate response, sort of how they do it, why they do it. If we put it under this umbrella, perhaps, of coalition building, this is kind of what Toronto is doing pretty explicitly, is trying to broaden the coalition around climate action. Does it really lead to more effective progress on climate response or on addressing inequality? So I've been thinking about doing some work on that kind of theoretically, but then doing case studies here locally, focused on Detroit, Cleveland, other legacy cities in the Midwest, where these issues of inequality are really, really pressing, but they don't have the same legacy or experience with climate policy. So that's where I've been spending a lot of my time lately.
Well, I really look forward to reading it. Syracuse, thank you so much for joining us. The book is Repowering Cities, Governing Climate Change Mitigation in New York City, Los Angeles, and Toronto, published by Cornell University Press 2019. It's available on the Cornell University Press website. You can check it out on Indie to find a bookstore near you. Right now, Labyrinth Bookstores in Princeton is offering free shipping anywhere in the United States and, I believe, elsewhere. Take advantage of that, support a nice brick and mortar bookstore that is remains independent and is a beautiful place to shop. Thanks again, Sarah, for your time. And yeah, we'll all be watching. You're on Twitter at @SarahHughes_TO, right? Are you from Toronto originally? Is that the TO?
No, but I started, I got a Twitter account while I was in Toronto. So. Okay.
All right. So follow Sarah on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter. Let us know what you think of the show. And we'll look forward to having Sarah back when she finishes some of this work on equality as well. All right. Thanks so much.
Thank you. What a treat.